Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on June 30th, 2015. I'm our Ruler of Time here alongside Rolo T. Chris, what's happening?
How goes it, Nick?
Pretty well right now. I'm just kind of allowing my brain to decompress currently. I had a very busy week last week.
Very compressive week.
I just to had to. Well, yes, that is basically exactly what I just said, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
There was pressure on it, if you will.
Like being in a vice grip.
Let's go with that, why not?
Alright, cool. I got a pretty metal imagery for that, then.
Yeah. I just pretend that I had my head in one of those, like, clampy devices that you use in, like, medieval torture things. Yeah.
Isn't that a vice?
Exactly.
Okay, cool. Alright, we're all on the same page, then.
I was adding additional details.
Okay, like, and the guy that's doing it's, like, fat, but, like, big, so he's still kind of scary.
What?
Yeah, but, like, you know...
Oh, like the guy in the, like, executioner
hood. Yeah, like, the guy in the executioner hood who's twisting it, it's, like, you know... He's not, like... It's like the mountain where you're, like, wow, that dude's nothing but muscle, but he's fat and big, so you're, like, that guy's still intimidating. Like a stereotypical biker image, you know?
Right, like a giant beer belly, but he's 7 feet tall, so you're... You don't really feel like making fun of him.
Yeah. Like Stone Cold at the latter end of his career, where he just clearly let himself go, but you're like, yeah, Stone Cold still probably beat me up. Yeah. Pop quiz, Nick. What's your favorite animal from World Trigger?
My favorite animal?
Yeah.
Well, there's the two, I guess. There's the capybara and there's the cat.
Yes, but one's the correct answer.
It's the cat.
Damn it. Alright, fuck. Alright. Well, alright. So, I went to the zoo 2 weeks ago with my sister, her husband, and my brother, and when we were there, one of the first animals we saw was the capybara.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been my first time seeing a capybara in person probably since I was a child. Nick, they are hideous creatures. Just yeah. Absolutely horrible. They are enormous rats, the size of most dogs. Probably go about to like stand up to like your knee or higher, maybe like halfway up your thigh. Just giant rodents with enormous eagle-like talons, but big stupid faces that remove any ability for them to be remotely intimidating. And one of their natural predators is a bird that literally just fucking stands in front of it and tries to peck out its eyes. So that when it's blinded, it can just fucking slowly eat it because the capybara is too lame and stupid to defend itself. I thought these things were the fucking worst. But then my brother and I were alone because my sister and her husband went on the safari. We didn't go because it was $6 more and I just wasn't doing that. And I was like, no way. So, you know how my brother and I are when we're together. We tend to like just bounce a joke off each other and it goes on for a while. The joke became that, like, my sister and her husband, like, started the safari, and, like, 3 minutes into it, the safari's like, all right, here's our first animal on the exhibit, we'll show you the capybara. And everyone's like, we just saw this thing already. And it's like, no, this capybara is actually going to come up on the bus with us, sit next to you, and fop, because he thinks he's people. And the joke just became that the capybara is just this annoying animal that follows us around everywhere. So, when they finally got off the bus, mind you, they've not been privy whatsoever to our entire conversation about the capybara. We demanded that we go back to the capybara so me and my brother can take a picture with it. And Nick, I think now I've decided that the capybara is my spirit animal. And should we ever become a house in Game of Thrones, I want it to be our sigil. I want it to be our direwolf, where it's like House Larios. Alarios rarely, if ever, pays his debts. And it's just a picture of a capybara with, like, one eye going one direction and one eye going the other.
House Larios. Aw, it thinks it's people.
Yeah. Ew, it smells.
God, what is... I think that there was a capybara in the Tick cartoon. I might be misremembering that, but basically, like, they end up in Central America at one point. And Tick gets hit on the head, and he stumbles into the jungle, and he comes across this capybara, and because he's hallucinating, he imagines it speaking to him. So he thinks it's a dog, and that it can talk, so he adopts it and names it Speak, because it can speak. And then he just takes it home with him. And he's just convinced that Speak can speak and that it's a dog for, like, the entire rest of the series. Like, he takes it to a vet at one point and is like, "What's wrong with Speak?" And the vet says, "It's got horrible worms and also it's not a dog, it's a capybara."
Fuck you, you're lying. I didn't realize these fuckers only survived 4 years in the wild as well. God, just... Fuck the platypus. You're the one motherfucker. I'm just like, what cruel god allowed you to live?
What's wrong with your face?
Oh, man. I feel bad for these guys. But now I have a fonder appreciation for the one on World Trigger.
Anyway, I don't know how we're going to get from that to talking about Slice of Life shoujo series, but we're going to attempt it. The last couple of weeks, we have been reading Taiyo no Ye, and I'm really not sure how I'm supposed to pronounce that last part. It's a weird... It's an I and an E together, and it looks weird, and Taiyo no Ye, I'm pretty sure that's it. And basically, it translates to House of the Sun, which is way easier to say, so maybe we should just stick to that. Basically, it's actually really hard to explain because it's a very soap opera-esque series where a lot of stuff happens over the course of it, and you just kind of have to just keep up with it as it's happening. And if you were to skip ahead, you would miss a lot of details because there are things that people know, and then different people find out about those things, and their reactions all change, and no one ever finds out about the stuff at the same time. It's always spread out between various different people, and so on and so forth. And it's going to, I think, be very difficult for me to actually recap this properly. But basically, the premise we start off with is that there's this girl named Mao, and when she was a kid, her parents fought a lot, so she didn't feel welcome in her own home. She felt that she was, like, the reason her mom and dad were fighting, and so she would go and spend time at this neighboring household with the Nakamura family. Then the Nakamura parents died in a car accident, so Mao drifted apart from her family of friends, basically. We start off the main plot line with Mao basically getting fed up with her father, who is trying to remarry, and basically she feels that she's being driven out of the home, so she leaves. She runs away from home. She comes across the oldest Nakamura child, Hiro, who has a job now, and he's like 24, and basically he takes sympathy on her and essentially lets her stay with him until she feels she can return home. And from there, we basically get the premise of Hiro wants his old family back because his two siblings have gone off to be with different family members while he stayed behind in the old house, and he wants to get his family back. But also, Mao and Hiro are falling in love.
Yes.
And that's basically it. But a lot of stuff happens after that.
It is a lot like a soap opera, as you said. It's a shoujo romance series, but it's also a bit more, I don't want to say broader than that, but it touches on another theme of generally just family, and particularly loneliness. That's a big crux to a lot of people in this series, is they want to be back with their family, or they don't want to be alone anymore. Finding a home, finding a place where you belong. That's Mal's sort of big character arc through most of this series is, you know, first she leaves because she feels she's being replaced, because someone sat at her seat during dinner one time. That seems to be the crux of why it initially happens, but we find out more. But it grows into a lot more than that, and the story does expand. It's a relatively, I don't want to say like a long ongoing series, but it's a lot happens in what probably in some other series would, you know, they'd still be at the point of like, oh, well, another situation's occurred that these two can't admit their feelings for one another. I mean, we're at a point by the end of it where she's now deciding if she wants to move for a third time. You know, it's a bit of a And it's right. And the situation expanded just beyond, I have a crush on my next door neighbor who was, you know, my childhood friend. How can I, you know, admit those feelings? She's now dealt with a lot more problems beyond that, and particularly involving her entire expanded family. So it's a lot that happens in this series. But it deals with a couple themes that I think make it a bit more interesting than your standard shoujo fare.
Well, and yeah, like you said, a lot of it has to do with family, and in fact, the romance subplot and the family subplot are kind of getting in each other's way at certain points. Basically, fairly early on, I think it's something like chapter 5, Mao just confesses to Hiro that she likes him.
Yeah.
And Hiro very strongly alludes in like chapter 12 or something that he also likes her. And so it's like, oh, come on, why can't these guys, you know, just freaking get on with it already? But then as you learn more about Hiro, you come to understand that it's basically because he is acting as Mao's family at this point. And so he doesn't feel as if he can actually move on to having a romantic relationship with her until she no longer has the family relationship with him. He wants her to be able to reunite with her actual family so that he no longer has to basically be a substitute parental figure to her.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of makes more sense than a lot of the series with the same premise of two characters like each other, but they just can't get on with it already. It's still a tremendous cock tease, you know, like with all freaking shoujo romances where they're just like...
You could say romance in general. I don't think we've...
Yeah, in general, yeah.
I think maybe like outside of like Bitter Virgin, I don't think we've read anything that's been romantic in the slightest that hasn't just prolonged itself indefinitely because it's the only crux the series can rely on.
Right. But it's a better justification for it than a lot of the ones that we've had to read.
Yes.
Also, it is another series in which... basically a girl gets adopted and ends up falling in love with her adopter. You got us again, guys. But this one was fine, though.
Yeah, this one doesn't end up in very creepy... Well, I guess we haven't seen how it completely ends, so maybe it does end where she's just like, I always thought of you as my father. He's like, and I always thought of you as my daughter. Let's bang now.
Just so that we're clear, I find you hot because you were acting as my family.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's also...
No, the series was over. The series concluded, didn't it?
I didn't think so. I thought it still was over.
Did you get to the point... Did you get to chapter 50?
I got to, like, 48, I think.
Well, it ends...
I saw it was still ongoing, so
chapter
I...
Chapter 50.
I saw it was still ongoing.
Really?
So, yeah.
I think that... Well, it ended last year. I'm pretty sure that you got that wrong. If you... I mean...
I was probably just mistaken on that, then.
Well, if you get to a point where they've actually confessed to each other, then the series is done.
Basically. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right,
spoilers,
so
they end up getting together.
Well, there we go.
Although I'm pretty sure you shouldn't be too shocked to join that.
I'd also like to note, this is another series where the female lead in a romance series also has a side career as a cell phone novelist.
Yeah, that was weird.
But this one, I guess... It's not like it plays that much more of a dramatic role in the series, but
it doesn't.
Somehow slightly more memorable than Watashi ni Shinisai or whatever that fucking series I read before.
Yeah, it was weird that because it was far less essential to the plot, but they make a much bigger deal out of it by the end, even though it's kind of forgotten in the middle. It's weird.
Yeah.
And really, it only pertains to Mao, Hiro, and this one other love interest of Hiro's. Also the series does one of those, every character with a crush on someone has someone else who has a crush on them. It's basically this long web of love triangle connections. Basically, any time a character is introduced who either has a crush on Mao or Hiro, it guaranteed that there is another character who has a crush on them. Always. I don't think there's a single exception to that.
Yeah, and it's a lot of like, well, this relationship didn't work out, but don't worry, this person's going to find love somewhere else. I guess the only time there's really any kind of, and I don't know, I may have forgotten if they actually do make up. I don't think they ever leave on bad terms, but I guess the only relationship that doesn't, like, get happy-go-lucky afterwards is, Mao and, oh, what's her name? She goes by Radical. She's, like, the other cell phone
Radical novelist. Is a much better name.
I forget her, Sugimori or whatever.
Sugimoto.
They both have...
I have the cast list up.
Thank God. They both have a crush on Hiro, and eventually, you know, the other girl, Sugimoto, realizes she has a crush on... You know, he has a crush on her. And they kind of... They don't, like, have, like, a spat, but they stop... Like, for a while, it seemed like they were going to become buddy and friends, and after that, it's just sort of like a very distant relationship between, like, I guess if I pass by you in the mall, I won't mace you sort of thing.
I think that's the general relationship strangers tend to have with each other, Chris.
You know what? If I had mace on me and I was passing down to the mall with other people...
I don't like
people,
the look of that guy.
I'd just be like, I don't like the cut of your jib.
You bump my elbow, Sirx.
What are you doing going into Young Justice? Because I'm a 12-year-old girl! Not anymore, you're not. Now you're just pepper sprayed.
So let's see. So in addition to Mao and Hiro, Hiro has his two siblings, one of which is Daiki, his younger brother, who happens to be Mao's almost exactly her age. Guess who has a crush on Mao from that, right?
Which is shocking, because he's such an asshole when you first meet him. His first chapter is like the epitome
I don't
of
want
glasses
you to stay
douche. It's so smarmy and cocky. Like, this is the first time she's seen him in what's probably been about like 7 or 8 years. And he shows up, she's like,
"Oh, you're so tall."
He's like, "Yeah, obviously I would have gotten taller after 7 years. You didn't expect me to be the same height I was when I was 7. Like, no, fuckhead. I guess I didn't.
She said she was surprised at how tall you got.
Yeah, it's just like, but she, you know. Because
he's a tall dude.
Yeah, but of course Mal's like a fucking, you know, she's just like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean anything by it." I'm just like, no, he's the asshole here. That was a pure grade A dickball move right there.
But then from there, you just kind of find out he just has this very blunt personality, though.
Yeah, and he doesn't like her when he first meets her either, so kind of understand why he's being a shithead to her.
Well, and he already has a crush on her, too, so you can understand him being kind of awkward around her after so many years.
True.
And Hiro's other sibling is Chihiro, who basically... It's weird because it feels like she should have had a more important role to the story than she ended up having. She doesn't really show up often enough to leave too much of an impact beyond being the last piece of the puzzle, basically. Because not too long after Daiki shows up, basically he just says, yeah, I'll stay, you know, in this house for a while, and he's planning on leaving afterward. But then he decides to stay there, in large part because of Mao's influence. But Chihiro... The other one that, you know, Hiro wants to come back so that the whole family can be together, she has this very complicated issue that she's dealing with, which is the fact that
she's a Medusa.
What's that?
She's a Medusa, and if you stare at her, you turn to stone.
Not Chihiro. I'm talking about Hina this whole time. Chihiro is actually Mao's friend. I got their names confused. Whatever. Anyway, Hina... is got, like, guilt issues. She, like, blames herself for their parents' deaths, and that's why she doesn't want to actually rejoin them. And that whole issue was dealt with in basically the span of one late chapter in the series. It's introduced and then dealt with almost immediately. It's kind of weird that she is, you know, one of the more important players of this whole entire secondary plot that deals with the second strong theme of the series, and that's her entire involvement. We don't really get to know her beyond that at all.
Which is weird, because she was also one of the first characters sort of that poses any sort of situation as, because the only reason that Mao has a room to go to when she starts living with Hiro is because she was, you know, was supposed to start living with him, and at the last moment she's like, no, I won't. So he's like, aww, I'm lonely and you're lonely, so let's be lonely together.
Yeah, it's weird because the series doesn't have... It's weird because it has antagonists, almost, but they're not bad, if you get what I'm saying. basically, bad stuff has happened to people, and some of them just haven't managed to deal with it very well. And because they haven't managed to deal with it, they're causing their loved ones to suffer. That's a recurring thing between Mao's situation and Hiro's situation. Because you've got, you know, Hina being all self-blaming on her side, and that's why the family can't get back together, and so all the siblings aren't feeling as happy as they could be. Then on the other hand, Mao's got this weird complicated thing going on with her parents, because her dad basically got together with her mom because he got her to see that the guy that she was with at that time wasn't good for her. And then they got together and they had Mao together, but then she ended up cheating on him with the original guy, and then it basically shattered her dad to the point where Mao constantly reminds him of his cheating ex-wife, and so he basically can't stand to be around her, even though he wants to be able to care for her as a father. And so he ends up trying to, like, drive her away so that she'll be happy somewhere else, but he also wants to be with her. It's weird. And it's complicated. But you can sort of see how someone being screwed up by something like that would just, you know, be fucked up, basically.
Yeah. It's not... Her story, like, it's a story that has a lot of silly drama to it, but it never feels like silly drama because everything does seem reasonable and explainable as it happens. You know, you're never like, oh, well, that just seems like a crazy, you know, character reaction to have. Like, the first chapter, I was like, why is she so mean to her stepmom when you're like, you know, the only thing her stepmom did was like, oh, hey, do you want dinner? And she's like, fuck this woman! But, you know, you find out, like, oh, okay, their relationships with these people aren't quite as one-sided as you think they are. And for, you know, the most part, the start of the story, you're really only getting her side of things. And you do start to see, like, oh, okay, no, she really is just kind of overthinking things or just having kind of issues with her family because it is sort of a really weird and awkward situation that she has.
And also, Mao actually ends up having this very sweet relationship with her stepmother. Like, by the end of the series, you know, basically, eventually, Mao does end up going back to live with her family, with her dad and with her stepsister and stepmother. And her stepmother is kind of fucking great to her. She, you know, entrusts her with stuff, and they go out together, and they have this nice relationship. And she's actually calling her mom before too long. And it's like, oh, this is very sweet and stuff. And then her real mom shows up, and it's like, ah, fuck you. So they're sort of just obstacles to the happy ending, I guess, more than there are villains. It's just people that are, you know, acting in ways that they think are in their best interest, and sometimes they aren't. And so people just have to make decisions. And the drama comes from the fact that you want certain people to be happy, and sometimes there are conflicts in the way that not everyone can be happy, and so inevitably someone's going to cry.
Yes. Which is life.
Yeah. Well, it's also soap opera.
Yeah. I mean, well, no one comes... It's not the worst kind of soap opera, though, because there's no one coming back from the dead. There's no, like...
Yeah. Ah, you're back. No, I am his twin brother.
Yeah, I'm his clone.
Played by the same actor.
I'm his clone from the future with a mustache. Like, oh, I didn't see this coming. I enjoyed this series in the sense that we don't often, when we do Sojers on this show, we don't generally get series that I'm able to be engaged with much at all. Normally, when I'm reading a shoujo, I tend to fall to the point where I'm picking it apart more than I'm able to enjoy it. Like, what was the maid one where the fucking, like, most popular girl in school had to become a maid for the douchey guy?
Oh, yeah, like, and then there was the guy who tried to rape her, so she had to be saved. Yeah.
You're just like, God, these series suck. Right? When you're reading those, you're like, these are awful. But this one, I was like, I could enjoy this. I don't think I would never read this for leisure. You know, this is just not my sort of style. But as an example of the genre, I could definitely appreciate it and say this is one of the better ones I've read from my perception of things.
Yeah, I would not strongly recommend it if you're not into this type of series, but at the same time, if you're going to read one from this genre, honestly, there's actually quite a few examples of levity and comic relief that I thought were actually very effective and were one of the main reasons why I was able to just keep on reading the series. Because as weird as some of the situations are, in order to induce drama on the situation, the characters just have these weird senses of humor. And for, like, Mal shifts between a lot of them. Like, sometimes she's just very deadpan. Sometimes she'll just be obsessed with some weird little thing. I think one of the first times that I got a nice little chuckle out of the series was Mal and Hiro basically go to see this movie. It's this, like, historical Japanese drama. And Hiro actually wants to go see it because of the romance, which is, you know, kind of the joke. You know, he gets all teary-eyed over it. And then when he and Mal walk out, Hiro's like, oh, that was nice, and it was a nice story. And Mal just says, the sword fights weren't very good. He's like, I like you, Mal. And that joke comes up again later on. Like, they put on, like, this play where she at the restaurant where she and Daiki work. And Mal says, I wonder what kind of stuff they'll have. Maybe there will be sword fights. And Daiki says, well, no, we get a lot of female patrons, so there will probably be a lot of romance. And so Mal goes, romantic sword fights. You know, that kind of stuff. It's like, I like that. And also, just whenever they just have these weird, dry moments of just deadpan humor. And so it kind of broke up the general just kind of sense of very stereotypical shoujo romance, whatever, So, pretty good.
Yeah. Better than expected. Don't go out and read it, though, if it's not a genre you generally care for.
Also, there is one moment where Mal is basically telling her friend Chihiro about the situation with Hiro, and Hiro just says, you know, I can't believe that, you know, you waited until you weren't living together before, you know, you actually considered a romantic relationship. I mean, I would have just dated him while we were living together. And then we'd go at it for hours.
Giggity.
So, I mean, the situation itself, it makes sense. It's not super cheesy. Characters are pretty likable. And good moments of comic relief. So, I actually would say, yeah, for this type of series, which, as we've said, neither of us typically like, pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say it's the best that we've read. I think there was one better, but I can't remember what it was called.
I know we both like Skip Beat a lot, although that was a little bit different from this.
Yeah, it was. So yeah, that is going to do... Oh, we also like Fruits Basket, I guess. That was a very different series from this one, though, too.
Yeah.
It was far less... That was way just wackier. Yeah. Also, I hate honey. Anyway, so... still haven't let it go. Yeah, I guess... are we done on that?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So, let us move on to the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap, then. See, Black Clover, right?
Yep, starting with Black Clover.
Oh, pardon me.
Good lord. Keep it together, Nick.
No. Chapter 19, Memories of You.
Memories of you. Memories of me. It sounds like a fucking Creed song or something, like a Nickelback.
Yeah. Well, no, Nickelback would be like, Memories of You, or something like that.
I feel like you could put Nickelback to a lot of scenes of Black Clover, though, and it might fit. It might be appropriate.
There you go. I mean, that kind of sums up both of those things, doesn't it?
rather concisely, okay.
Yeah. So, last time on Black Clover, Asta got knocked through a wall, and he saw this sword that Nero was perched on top of. And Chris and I disagreed on where it came from, but it doesn't really matter. So, Asta reaches out for the sword, as Mars just kind of stands there in his crystal golem thing.
He does. He's just sitting there like, twinge, twinge, gish.
Time for a flashback now.
I'm not exactly Zabuza. You see, they never had a flashback to show you what Zabuza had a friendship with any of the kids he had to kill. See, I'm different.
Basically, he remembers that girl that he met in his childhood that was alluded to in the last chapter. She was one of the other candidates in their whole super soldier training program and over in his kingdom. And then came time for the final drill where they're basically all made to kill each other. And so Mars won. He, I guess, actually specifically had to strike her down as well. So, and also, as she was the last one to be killed, they said, oh, let's combine Mars with Thana, that's a weird name, with her ability, which explains, I guess, where his two different sources of mana come from. It's from the crystal embedding surgery thing. And also, his Toma is apparently made up between, like, just stitching the two of them together, which you would think would be... That's not the way that you actually know. Are like, half the pages, like, melded together as well?
It's such an elegant way of doing it, too. Like, we finally perfected our power, our process of combining two major spells together. What'd you do it? Then we stapled two books together. Like, it looks
well,
so...
Well, my problem is...
It looks so slapdash when you see it. It's like some fucking Frankenstein book.
Which, I mean, I don't mind the fact that the two books are put together, but when you think about it, if you want two different books to be put together, what do? You take off the back of one and the front of the other, and you stick them together that way. You don't, like, tear the pages in half and stick them to the other book's half pages.
I can't even comprehend how exactly the process works, because you even see in the way that it's torn apart, each cover, and even the binding itself... is, like, split in half. So it really feels like this was an arduous process. Like, they had to, like, dissect it and, like, you know, sew them together several times at different locations.
Yeah, the only thing that should be torn up is the spine. That's it. So, anyway. Plant girl.
I have to make a comment on this, though. Like, someone pointed out to me that...
Oh.
In the panel with Noelle laying on the ground wounded, like, from the perspective of it, and, you know, the joke of how short her skirt is, you can actually see, like, the very bottom of her butt cheek from underneath, like, her dress, and I wasn't going to call attention to it, I wasn't going to really note it until someone brought it up, and it's like the fucking photo of the old woman in the hag, or the young woman in the hag. Once
right.
I've seen it, I can't unsee it. I can't
unsee it. Your eyes just focus on it, and it's like, that's where the butt cheek is. Yep.
Have you ever seen Vi splash art from League of Legends?
Yes.
If you look at it, she has one of her butt cheeks is poking out from beneath her legs. That one bothers me more because the anatomy of that shot suggests she has, like, a really saggy butt for some reason. But it's just the thing that once I've seen it, it ruins the image because I can't stop, like, I can't, I, like, you specifically drew that. Like, there was a point where you were like, no, I know this is supposed to be a dramatic scene, but a little bit of butt because it would be there. There we go.
I think, honestly, neither of them really, like, distracting too much because at this point I've just kind of grown to accept it, you know? It's like, well, it's a shonen manga, it's League of Legends art, of course it's gonna be, like, unnecessarily sexualized woman.
Sure.
Of course you can see her butt from the front. What's so weird about that?
It's just weirdly distracting at certain points during this chapter, which is a shame because as far as, like, building Noelle up, this was one of the better chapters, too.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird. It's like, you know, you take the good with the bad. You take, you know, the character background and the build-up, and you take the bleeding breasts with barely covered nipples and butt cheek from the front.
Yeah.
That's a weird image in general. Like, yeah. Anyway, so Mimosa, that's her name, right. She is like, I have to heal Noelle with my best spell. And she has a flashback to when she and Noelle basically spent time together and stuff. And, you know, basically, Mimosa just relates that the rest of the royals essentially looked down on Noelle because she had no control of her magic, and so she would work really hard like a peasant would in order to make up the difference. Whereas Mimosa actually really admires that about Noelle because she's got that power to just work really hard, something that royals just don't do. And so, you know, she just concludes that, you know, in the present, you know, you can work hard and I really respect you for that, so you must not die. So, that's kind of, that's a nice sentiment. Yeah. Anyway, Mars is just like, fuck you over there, and throws crystals at them, But Asta
crystal shurikens of some kind, because they spin.
Right. So Asta's like, shuriken never work! And he jumps in and he slashes them apart. And yeah, he's like, I can deflect magic, And he says, oh, your opponent is right here. And he slashes through more attacks. You know, where was all that, I will just attack you with something faster stuff, Mars? Come on, man. Seriously.
Well, I wonder if it's... Do you think he actually is cutting magic the same way he was before?
I don't know.
It's tough to know, because he gets a new sword this time. And this new sword is smaller and thinner, so, you know, presumably he's able to use it to, you know, be more agile and
well, and he's wielding it in one hand. So,
yeah, maneuverable in combat. And at the end of it, we also find out, spoilers for 20 seconds from now, he can shoot out, like, a energy magic slash of some kind.
Right.
So, I'd have to assume there's some drawback to the sword. Because I'd like to think, like, oh, well, yes, this sword's faster, it has this special slash, but the sword itself can't actually cut through magic the same way your other sword did. Or something like that. Because the thing he smashes through before are just crystals, so I could think, like, maybe it's just force that's doing that. Because I came to the idea, like, maybe this is...
I think you're thinking a bit too much into it.
I'm also thinking the series is trying to rip off Rave Master, maybe, at this point, too, so he's getting a collection of different swords that have different abilities, so I don't know.
Well, I never read or watched Rave Master, so...
Oh, okay.
So Asta's like, oh, it doesn't matter how much I deflect stuff, you know, he's got the flame recovery magic, so I can't finish him off. So Noelle manages to recover enough so that she kind of props herself up and says, oh, come on, Dorkster. I just thought of that just now.
I'm the best.
you know, she says, you know, I am a royal and you're the first commoner that I ever acknowledged. That guy is nothing, so hurry up and crush him. And so Asta's like, okay, boob lady.
It is. It's the other thing that bothers me in this chapter is that both of these shots of her... It's done from a perspective where you see her face, but then you just see the top parts of her breasts.
I never realized that. Noelle's uniform must be very, like, slimming and confining, because, Jesus, her tits look way bigger.
I think they're just fake, Nick. Real tits don't sit like that.
She just, like, used her water magic to give herself a or some shit.
She's like, boom, chesticles, water magic. I hate it, because I feel like this is what I'm commenting on in the series instead of, like, the content at this point, just, like, the weird stuff that bothers me. Because, on a whole, I actually don't mind this chapter a terrible lot. It's just little things like this I keep seeing just bother the shit out of me, because I can't unnotice them.
Right. So, yeah. You know, Asta's like, I don't have magic, but I do have friends! And then he slashes the sword through the air and it sends out a wave of magic. Basically, he does, like, the original Legend of Zelda full hearts sword burst thing.
What's the thing Ichigo does? Tetsu Gaia?
Getsuka Tensho.
Yeah, it looks kind of like that, too. Just gray instead of pure black.
Right. But yeah, that was Black Clover. Asta sure has bullshit powers, doesn't he? Yeah.
If he were to get a collection of swords, Nick, would that be more interesting to you? If he had, like, swords that had varying
abilities.
He's
got to do something different, doesn't he? Besides just negating magic, so...
Yeah, yeah, like, maybe he's like Urza, but he actually does have, like, a power
maybe
scale.
Maybe he actually has to earn them.
Yeah, he's like, I have to find the swords, as opposed to them just spontaneously appearing in my inventory.
I train all the time, you know, I just go into my, you know, wardrobe of a billion powers, and I occasionally find new stuff.
Urza's that character in an MMO who plays, like, the ridiculously hot chick, and guys run up to her all the time and just give her free equipment, and then just appears in her inventory.
So mean!
I'm just saying, she hasn't earned any of it.
So what you're saying is that Urza is actually played by a guy.
Yes, I guarantee it. If Urza, the way she is, was fucking real person, yes, it would be absolutely played by a guy. It's being played quite clearly by a fucking hero at the moment.
Okay, we've got to actually wait to get into Fairy Tale.
We don't have Fairy Tale this week, actually, so we won't have it to bring up.
Oh, because it didn't come out yet, right.
Yeah, sadly. But we have Bleach, Nick. We can contain ourselves with Bleach.
632, Friend 2. So, last time we began the flashback with Baz B and Jugo, and apparently...
The long-awaited flashback.
Apparently we're actually continuing it now. So, basically, Baz is like, we shall, you know, get ready to take our revenge on Jubok, and he's, like, narrating to himself, like, I'm still super awesome, but Jugo still has no talent as a Quincy. He still can't even collect a reishi to make a bow. But, you know, he's worked super hard. He trained super hard the sword and the bow to make up for that lack of talent, and I just couldn't leave him behind because he was trying so hard. But, whatever. So then we made our move, and so... Basically, like, frickin' Sternritter army comes in. By the way, I actually looked up something that bothers me. They are wearing uniforms, Juhabok's army is. Their uniforms have neckties.
Okay.
Neckties were not created until, like, 1600s. This takes place 1,000 years ago.
You found it, Nick. You found the one loophole in Bleach. Send a letter into Kubo. He might end the series.
Can you imagine?
He's just like,
someone would call me on the necktie problem.
I deeply apologize for my offending anybody by including neckties before they were actually invented. In reparations, I shall end the series of Bleach now, so it does not further shame my company.
This actually did really bother me as soon as I saw these soldiers. Because you can tell, like, they're like, super modern-looking military uniforms. Like, you know, 1900s military uniforms. Because they're meant to, you know, be, you know, freaking SS, German Army type stuff. And, yeah, it's just, you know, coming through these, you know, freaking pre-medieval times. Wearing freaking neckties and slacks and shit.
It's like, they're like, yeah, we are from the 1,000 years ago. We are the Nazi part. I mean, the SS units that fights for the great glorious Jord Buchbach. Have you seen my iPhone 4? It's very nice, yes.
Oh, yeah. It was created in the 1010.
Yeah.
So, basically, soldiers from the Sternritter are like, we're recruiting people. And... if you want to join the Quincy's, you can fight with us. So Baz shows up and he's like, hi, I'm Baz, and this girly-looking motherfucker is Jugo. Look at him and his weird sleeveless top.
That is a weird top. Was he wearing that in the previous scenes?
I don't know.
Yeah, I guess he was.
It's just a weird...
No, I guess it doesn't have sleeves. Huh, fair enough. You know what? Let him have his bold fashion sense. He's like, look, are these guys gonna have fucking neckties? I wanna wear this, this sleeveless apron.
Jugo's just shit. Like, look, Kubo drew it for me, so, you know, just let him think that his clothes look cool, okay?
Look, he's really trying to hint at there being some yaoi relationship between us. Clearly I'm the bitch in this relationship, so...
So... Baz's like, we want to enlist in the Sternritter thingy. And everyone's like, oh my god, what is that kid doing? Well, he says he wants to enlist, like the guy asked. What's so foolish about, you know, doing that? It's not like he's doing anything stupid. He doesn't do anything stupid until they're like, you will have to wait. We are going to hold tests at a later time. So hone your skills until then. Though I doubt they'd accept a nobody like you. Like, needlessly bitchy. This is the way to recruit people into your army, right?
By the way, have we told you all that we're evil?
If you will all try to join the army. Alright, I want to try and do that. Oh, hold on, you'll have to wait till later. And also, you will totally not make it.
Also,
don't even bother.
Also, you are taste sucksaws. Oh. Tesuxos was a very well-known...
how dare you attack my horse!
It's a very well-known 980-year-century phrase, yes.
980-year-century phrase.
We said it all the time in 980. That's, yes, we had it back when there were only 4 numbers in the calendar. Three numbers.
Tonight we're going to party like it's 999.
Yeah.
So...
It just sounds like a Taylor Swift new album.
Oh, do you not know who she is? She is a pop country singer. You do not know what pop country is. It is very popular with the bards these days.
Yes, the bards. There's some guy who's like, good touch, good touch. Like, he just whispers something. Yeah, yeah, I saw the tool.
I think they bought this.
So gullible.
So Baz attacks the guy's horse, and he's like, oh, why don't you fight me if you don't think I'm strong? And if I win, you'll give me your position. And the guy's just like, I will kill you then, asshole. And, yeah, he's kind of an idiot, isn't he? So he tries to fight Baz, and the guy, like, charges towards Baz while drawing his sword, and Baz also charges the guy while lowering his crossbow. I don't think Baz understands how to fight with a crossbow.
This is gonna go so awesome for me!
I can attack this guy from literally hundreds of times further away than he can. Time to get closer!
Time to get in killing distance!
But all of a sudden, someone shows up with hockey that presses them into the ground. No way, it's their spirit pressure, whatever it's called. So, yeah, it's Jubak, and he's like, I'm also here on my horse. And basically, all the townspeople are so crushed under his spirit pressure that they collapse to the ground. The guy that Baz was going to fight gets down on one knee and is like, oh, I'm so sorry. I can't believe how I let him, you know, gall me into this and stuff. And Jubak says, no, it's okay. I have only come here to...
Nick, that's not Jubak's voice.
It's fine. I only came to pick up something I've been looking for.
There
to pick up the one who is to become my right arm. So Baz's like, yeah, it's me. I will be your right arm. And then kill you, Jubak. And he's like trying to stand up under Jubak's spiritual pressure. But when he manages to lift his head up off the ground, he sees that Jugo is standing in front of Jubak, not affected by his spirit pressure in the slightest. And Jubak says, it's you. I know your name, Jugram Hashvalt. Together, we are whole. Which brings the yaoi connotations of this whole sequence to a new, disgusting level, by the way.
Yeah, certainly a little bit. I like to think that Jubak's doing this, he's just like, it was foretold in the prophecy that my right arm would be the boy with the brightest eyelashes in the world.
Also, he would wear a very come-hithering top.
He would come to me in a nightgown with pants.
Come, my lady. Come, come, my lady. Come-hithering. I'll have to remember that one. So, yeah, well, I guess that this is more to establish that thing that Bazby was alluding to before we got into the flashback where Jugram and Jubak share power and it shifts between them. Presumably they are, like, connected by fate somehow. But yeah, it's really weird. It's just like, you know, bearded lord on a horse comes to pick up the young peasant, pretty peasant boy, to become whole with him. Yeah, it's a little bit too easy, okay?
Yeah, you know what? I'll go with it. It's more interesting than this chapter ended. Like, hey guys, Jubak still got a castle. Have you seen it yet?
This is definitely more preferable than like the last. God, Bleach is so weird, isn't it? It's like, no, this wasn't very good, but they're not ending it the same way as last week. So
yeah, like we're still not getting like wacky Aizen shown up to be like. There never was a castle. I was the castle. You've all been inside of me. I'm a playset. You're all Legos.
Unohana's still dead and never coming back.
Like, that's the shit I've wanted, but, like, look, we've got, like, a month and a half of, like, have you seen Jubak's castle? Like, yes, it looks great.
Oh, it's so wonderful, isn't it?
I don't think you've seen it. I'm going to show it to you next week, and then you're going to really be impressed. And then the week after that, you're going to find out Jubak made the Stern Raiders. We've known that for like a year and a half now.
I think you're underestimating that substantially. Okay. So, shall we move on then?
Yes.
Skipping over Fairy Tale to Food Wars. Chapter 124, Seeing the School Anthem. So, basically, we essentially are getting an explanation of what the fuck Soma is planning with that weird cart that showed up at the end of the last chapter. So essentially, he is going to make black pepper pork buns, and I guess the reason why the car is essential is because of the oven that's in it. I think that's what we learn eventually. They, as in Soma and Megumi, are kind of rushing around, gathering up the last of their stuff to do, I guess, last-minute preparations for the festival. They come across Isami and Takumi, the two brothers whose names I always forget, but Megumi said them both in one word bubble, so thanks for that.
You're welcome, and, Nick!
And so they're like, yeah.
You, Nick, you have to thank her.
No. So they are like, yes, and we are setting up our own booth on Main Street. And yeah. And he's like, also, I'm different now from Stagiaire Week, so don't mistake me for the man I was during the classic. You hear that? Nuki Hero, don't you forget it, as his brother is dragging him off. Then Soma spots Alice and Hayama arguing while Kurokiba stares passively into the distance. And, you know, Alice is like, why do we have to do curry stuff? And
no, Nick, it's, God! Why do we have to do it? Does it have to be curry?
Does it have to be curry?
Oh my God!
Well, yes, we're going to call in the seminar's official sponsor for help, too, so you don't get us saying that. What? But then, like, what's the point of me even being here?
And then she says a musical note at one point. That's what Professor Siami said! Music note.
I hope she says exactly like that.
This is Dotson. It's like her period.
She says
now.
Like the type of music note it is too.
She's like clap note.
You know that's not what it is.
I have no idea. I never learned to play a single instrument, Nick.
Isn't that that's an eighth note. I remember that. Yeah, because it's a quarter note when it's a one standing by itself without the flag, and then it's a 2/8 if it's two of them with the bar between them, so the flag lowers to indicate if it's a 1/8.
Nick, I was about to high-five myself for knowing a clef note, and I don't even know if that's musical related. I think that might be something for fucking, like, writing.
This is, like, freaking knowledge from, like, I don't know, third grade semi-weekly music class coming in here, so...
Of all the nerds I was throughout school, I was unfortunately never a band nerd. I was a choir boy for 1 year, but then I got kicked out because I was having too many disciplinary problems. I was the bad boy of choir.
Nice.
Which does not earn you as much respect from the ladies as I thought it would.
So... We also get this little flashback to when Alice talked with Professor Shiomi, as in June, to basically, I guess, get her permission to make the booth together with Kurokiba and Hayama. And essentially June's reaction was, oh, Hayama's made a friend his own age! Ah! And it's weird because, like, there are specifically little notes around her face that say motherly love. And just remember, it's like, these two are also supposed to be like, having that romantic relationship thing. It's weird. Okay. Anyway. So, Soma kind of has his own little flashback to when he was a kid and learned to make pork buns from his dad. And... yeah.
Done. Yeah. He's going to make pork buns, but there's a secret behind it he's not going to spoil yet.
Right. And essentially, that was the reason for the special cart, which is it has the type of onion that you can make them in. It's this weird kind of bucket that you can stick them to the inside rim, and then they cook on the inside of it, and they can pull them out. So, portable oven. Round. Special. Yes.
It's very important.
So, they go back into, like, the kitchens to actually perfect the pork filling so that it's as good as they can. They even consult with Ikumi about it because she is meat expert and stuff. And then it's time for the first day of the school festival. Everyone gathers for opening ceremonies and stuff, and Soma and Megumi come across Alice again, and her partners are very drained from something. Supposedly, Alice was just dragging them around. They see the council members kind of walking by, and then someone announces, "We will now conclude the opening ceremonies with a chorus of the Totsuki Seryo Culinary Institute's official school anthem." And someone's like, "Ha, a school anthem? I didn't even know he had one of those. Right, Tadakuro?" And immediately Megumi and every other student surrounding him just burst into song, singing the whole thing. And so just like looking back and forth, like, everyone knows the song.
Do you remember your alma mater, Nick?
I don't think we had one in my school.
I definitely had one when I was in high school, and I'm trying to remember what it is. I'm about to type it into Google as though this would come up, but we'll see.
Let me see if I can find mine.
Alma mater. All right. Oh, wait. Hold on. I think this might be it. Oh, alma mater. No, wait, that can't be right. Oh, wait. No, this is. Wait, this can't be right. This must be for a different Bishop McDevitt. Okay, this is a different Bishop McDevitt High School. Aw. I got so excited at first. Maybe this one.
Let's see.
Oh, wait. Here it is. I do actually have mine.
I don't think my school has an alma mater.
Do you want me to do mine, Nick?
Go right ahead.
Hail to thee, our alma mater. Hail to thee, our gold and blue. May the man... I don't think there actually was a song to this. I was just singing it as one. May the memory of your council keep our hearts serene and true. Hail your noble towers rearing upward to God's holy throne. It's going to be kind of preachy, Nick. It's a Catholic high school.
Yeah.
Signifying truth and science of eternal wisdom. This structure is all wrong, but I'll finish up here. May your precepts fill this great, then let them reach unto the sky. Lead your children unto heaven. Hail to thee, McDevitt High.
Actually, I was trying to do the same thing in my head as I was reading through this, because I was like, how are you going to actually sing along to this, I wonder? Of course, these are also lyrics translated from Japanese, so I'm sure the rhythm will be all off for that, too.
Yeah, we're just, like, making up shit as we go along.
Right. Like, actually, that reminds me, I actually recently watched Sister Act, that Whoopi Goldberg film from the 90s.
One or two?
The first one.
Okay.
It was okay, you know, but honestly, like, there weren't a lot of actually, like, funny moments. The only ones, the jokes that I remember that were actually good were, like, when Whoopi Goldberg gets kidnapped, and they don't, all the other nuns are trying to figure out who did it, and one of them just says, maybe it was Catholics. It's like, okay, that was funny.
They were pretty devious like that.
And then later on, you know, they learn from Maggie Smith, you know, she's like, you know, she's not really a nun. And they're like, oh, but she taught us to sing so beautifully. And the same woman who made the Catholic comment is like, oh, that should have tipped us off. Okay, that's pretty good, too. Anyway, I'm getting off track here. Food Wars! Anyway, so after someone gets thoroughly embarrassed for not knowing the words to this song, the headmaster is just like, all right, the Moon Festival's open. And that's the end of the chapter. So, yeah. Preparation's done. Time for the, I guess, unofficial showdown between Kuga and Soma.
Yes. I'm excited for it. It's been short, but I'm ready for this to get going.
I imagine before we actually get into that, we're going to get a whole bunch of people making, you know, orgasm faces from all the other booths.
Well, so, yeah, obviously. Holy shit, I didn't realize how huge this guy's hands are in My Hero Academia. Fucking the number four hero,
oh, yeah.
Gene. Good God, his fingers are enormous.
Yeah, those are weird hands. Actually, speaking of orgasm phase in Soma, did you hear about the like special mini crossover thing that Shonen Jump put out? It was like a bunch of the female protagonists. I think it was specifically the ones from series of the anime adaptations. Basically just like have this meetup and they eat food and a bunch of them have orgasm faces and stuff, but then at one point, like, because Sheikah's there,
yeah,
so they're like, I don't know about this. She is 11. And then she eats it. She just kind of, like, shakes her fist because it's so good. And they're like, oh, good. It was a mild one.
I do actually recall that, like, someone being like, yeah, and then Chica goes up and, like, shit gets real or something like that.
It's like, oh, thank God.
He's tasteful. Had this been fairy tale, it might have been a different reaction.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as we've
learned. As someone who already linked me apparently the leaked cover of Fairy Tale this week, where it's Wendy in a fucking bikini thrusting towards the screen.
And squirting people in the face.
Yeah.
Anyway, My Hero Academia, number 48, Getting the Knack. So, by the way, the front cover of Shonen Jump, fucking awesome. Stare off between Bakugo and Deku in their superhero outfits. That's looks so cool. Anyway, we kind of just begin the chapter by cutting around to a number of Deku's classmates as they meet up with, you know, representatives from their agencies and stuff. Bakugo meets up with some guy with giant hands named Best Genist, because his entire uniform is made of jeans, and he has, like,
I don't know why I didn't get that pun. But I sat there the entire time being like, why does his face look like, why does his collar look like a pair of pants, like even with little pockets in it?
Because it's jeans.
God, that's stupid, and I hate it now.
His hair is also really stupid, too. And Best Genius actually says that he specifically wanted to recruit Bakugo, who I guess chose him because he's one of the more popular heroes. And so he's like, you know, you're... All I've had lately are little do-gooders, but you're the first in a long time who's a bit more ferocious, and my job as a hero is reforming people like you. Heroes and villains are two sides of the same coin. I can see it in that glare of yours. So what is it that really makes someone a hero? So, basically, I guess, trying to, you know, drive into Bakugo, hey, maybe you should try to be a little bit more, you know, heroic.
Yeah, stop being such an asshole.
and then both Kirishima and
Tetsu.
Both of them end up getting put under the same hero, Fourth Kind, who has four arms. I guess.
Obviously.
Yeah. So they're like, why are you here? And they immediately like clasp hands as if they're going to arm wrestle, even though they have no platform beneath them. I don't know. So, you know, he's like, yes, I was allowed to take on two students. I want to tell you both about what this work is actually like. Are you guys listening to me? And then we also see Uraraka with the battle hero Gunhead. And I freaking love the little thing that Gunhead says, where he's just like, well, you know, my job is getting a handle on crime, so when something bad happens, the police call me for help. Each district sends their requests in batches, okay? I have nice reports describing how much help I was at catching bad guys and saving people. Once the specialty organization does its little examination, they put money into my bank account, okay?
It was weird. I guess it's a joke, though, that really doesn't work when it's translated to English. It's just like, the way he talks is really cute. I was like, I guess?
If you say so.
I guess because he says okay at the end?
It sounds like he's got a real attitude on him, doesn't he? Because that's how people use that when they tack it onto the ends of their sentences. I know it's like it must be like a verbal tic in Japanese, and sometimes those are considered really cute. Yeah, does not translate very well if you translate it that way.
It just sounds like he's condescending to him. Like, can you get it? I put a handle on crime, okay?
Yeah. Then when we get, I forget these two girls' names, but they've been there with the stake hero Uabami, and she's like, yeah, you know, I'm here doing side work, you know, I'm going to do stuff for sanctioned public service, and so, you know, it's like, it's, you know, a perk of being popular, which is why I'm about to shoot a commercial, so come along and watch. And they're like, I don't know about this, you know, but the other girl says, no, this is, you know, a path we won't be able to avoid when we go pro, so, you know, it's nice that they've got the attitude of, you know, we're here to learn. It doesn't matter, you know, exactly how we're going to be, what we're going to be doing. So let's just make the best of the situation that we can. So. And it's nice to see that extra side of it, you know, getting to see what heroes are like in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And then, meanwhile, Deku, Gran Torino is asleep, and he's blowing a very large snot bubble. Like, that is a very large snot bubble. I guess it'd be like half the size of his head. Also, we learned that Gran Torino is apparently very mysterious. He don't show up on Google.
No one can do that, Nick. Google is unbeatable.
So Deku just kind of, instead of going to sleep, goes outside and is like, I have to think of it more evenly. You know, quirks are as natural as breathing for guys like Kachan, and so I have to actually get beyond thinking of my powers in terms of using and not using. So he tries to basically jump between walls with his super strength, and so he directs power into his legs, and he jumps, and he face plants into the wall. Because, yeah. So he trains the whole night, trying to figure it out, and he hurts himself a whole lot, and doesn't go to sleep. Yeah. So Gran Torino basically tells Deku the story of how he was helping to train All Might, and he says, you know, the only thing that he really had going for him was his body. So we did nothing but spar until he was ready to puke. And so Deku's like, oh, so that's why he was so scared of this guy. Just punched him over and over again. But Gran Torino says, you know, I couldn't half-ass his training because he was entrusted to me by a dear departed friend, who Deku concludes was All Might's predecessor with the One for All power. So Gran Torino uses this little information to conclude that, you know, just how little All Might has told Deku about his past and stuff. Then a microwave shows up in from
Amazon.
Yeah. It's kind of weird that they just say the name of it, isn't it?
Yeah, delivered from Amazon. I was like, oh, was someone at your house also knocking?
No, someone downstairs is clapping really loudly.
Oh, I thought it was going to be super creepy. Like, we get to the part of the store where someone's knocking at a door and someone's knocking at your house. I'm like, Nick, you may get a microwave, or it could be a monster who's going to kill you. It's one or the other.
Candy grab.
Or it's that shark for the SNO things.
So, a microwave shows up from Amazon, and Gran Torino's like, somehow mine got broken yesterday, so I ordered this with fake news next day delivery. They heat up Taiyaki. I see Taiyaki actually show up a lot in, like, manga and stuff, because it's weird, because there's just no translation for it.
It's like, we put fish something in a pastry-ish sort of thing-ish.
It's not even fish stuff. It's just sweet paste in a pastry that's shaped like a fish.
It's like me trying to comprehend Yorkshire pudding. I've had it explained to me 1,000 times. I've made it myself, and I'm still like, I don't get what this is.
So they put a whole bunch of taiyaki on a plate, stick it in the microwave, and I love how, like, excited Gran Torino is over it. It's like, hey, we're having taiyaki for breakfast! Why are we doing that? Because I like sweet stuff!
Because I'm old, and who the fuck cares at this point?
He's just, like, beating on the table, oh, taiyaki, taiyaki.
I'll eat jelly beans for breakfast for all I fucking care.
Chris, do you think he's gonna get his peanuts?
He's gonna get them. He gets his taiyaki this chapter. I'm not worried about this old guy getting his food.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah. Deku is trying to ponder it as he's waiting for the microwave to be done. They take the taiyaki out, and Gran Torino bites into it. He's like, ah, it's cold! And Deku says, why is it cold? And Gran Torino says, oh, you idiot, look, you crammed them all on a plate that's too big, and they can't spin if the plate's too big. Only one part gets heated up. Have you ever used a microwave before?
I would like to side immediately with Gran Torino on this. This is infuriating. How can you be that stupid?
Improper microwave usage.
I'm like, Deku, I used to think you were just a little bit naive, but now you're the dumbest fucking person on the planet. How can you fuck up?
No idea how microwaves work. You have to freaking, if you've got too much stuff, you gotta, like, make a hole in the middle and spray it out into a ring. Come on, man.
Put it on a smaller plate, twist it around, make sure everything's getting evenly heated. God.
Yeah, don't just put it back in the microwave. Then you're gonna get, like, the outside be boiling hot. Come on.
It's the hot pocket theory.
Yes. So, Deku was like, wait a minute. I've got it. This Taiyaki, it's me. And Gran Torino says, No, it's not. What's wrong with you?
He's like, you're not a Taiyaki.
My dad's not a phone. So Deku's like, oh, what I meant was, see, up until now, I was focused on using my power, you know, like on-off switches. But then I realized from the start I should be throwing all the switches on at once, so that heat, which was only reaching a single part of me, I've got a picture it spreading around evenly. And he like flexes his arms and legs, and his entire body starts to churn with the one-for-all power. Although he's restraining it to like 5% capacity, so he's like, you know, I gotta have my whole body be continuously at the 5% limit. And so Grunter is like, so you're visualizing it like a Taiyaki in the microwave. Are you sure you're okay with something that boring?
Yeah, dude, like I was just shading it. I'm like, I know it's your grand moment of realization. It's a little bit lame, though.
So yeah, Deku says, yeah, but that's the inspiration I got from All Might. And so Gran Torino says, ah, well, can you move like that? I don't know. Why don't we find out? So they get ready to spar again.
Very cool chapter. I like the way that we're actually getting logic and sort of an example as to why Deku is getting stronger, as opposed to it just being like, oh, he figures it out or whatever. Like, he's actually, you know, we're seeing the reason, the mechanics behind this. I always think that's a much more satisfying way of doing these sorts of things. So, very cool chapter, I think. Overall.
Naruto, yeah?
Yes, Naruto.
Naruto, 7th Hokage and the Scarlet Spring. 700 plus 9. What is it freaking called?
I'll protect
time?
You.
I'll protect you. So, yeah, Shin makes an arm out of scalpels.
That's as you tend to do at times.
Yeah, so he's like, yeah, this will be my new arm now. Pimp in it.
Isn't this creepy?
Thanks for doing surgery, mommy, for some reason. Meanwhile, Naruto and company are traveling around within Sasuke Susanoo so that they can find Sakura. Sarada is kind of deep in thought over Sasuke and her whole parental situation and stuff. And then Naruto kind of places a comforting hand on her shoulder. And so Sarada just thinks to herself, yeah, I gotta stop thinking about this. It's just like the Lord Seventh said, right now, I just want to rescue my mom. They come across the base. As Sakura is fighting with Shin, they kind of just eventually burst through. Sasuke stabs into the cave with Susanoo, breaks off Shin's new arm, like just the new arm. What a conveniently placed attack. And then grabs him. Yep.
And beats him, basically. He's like, done. Boosh.
And Sasuke... oh, that's why he does that. He pulls the shrapnel, basically, out of Sakura's arm, and then lights it on fire with his Amaterasu. I was like, why are you bother doing that the first time I read this? And then I just realized, oh, it's because Shin can control weapons from a distance, so he's just destroying them completely. So, let's see. And Cho's like, oh, your dad's so cool, Sarada. Why can't he be my dad? Anyway.
JoJo still sucks.
So Shin is in bad condition, and so he's like, I gotta use the other Shins as a distraction and retreat. Okay, guys, kill them! And all of them stab him instead. He's like, what are you doing? And one of the Shins says, you're all disposable flesh now.
You're old. Like, they're all like teenage girls. Like, ew, you're so old. It's weird.
So he's like, but I'm the original. And they're like, well, your powers are weak now. And so from now on, we're going to evolve. That is the most logical. Sakura just says, you know, I kind of thought something like this might happen.
I always thought these freaky monster clones would turn out to be evil.
Oh, God. And so there's actually a shit ton of Shin clones now, and some of them look really weird, some of them are fatter than normal, some of them are gaunt, and the original Shin says, when did you multiply so many? And one of them just says, we created them, we don't need you anymore, so, yeah. So, Naruto uses his shadow clone technique so that he can help to fight off the clones. then this really huge Shin clone shows up, and Sasuke punches him in the face with his Susanoo fist thing. Then the original Shin is like, I need spare organs! And so he tries to space warp himself away using, I guess, and then also uses one of the little eye thingies to warp away the Sakura and Sarada and Chocho. And instead, Sarada spins around and punches it to death.
Yeah. She just fucking, like, twists. She's like, fuck this thing right here.
Yeah. And then the original Shin dies.
Oh.
Oh, there you go.
Leave the memories alone. Wait, does he die? Oh, yeah, he does. I thought for some reason he was the one saying.
Just looks down at him and said, he's dead.
I, for some reason, thought he was saying he's dead in reference to the little monster thing. I was like, I didn't care if he's dead or not anyway. No, this sad.
So, then they're like, well, there's still the army of clones we've got to deal with. So Naruto says, all right, let's get ready to go. And Sakura, you know, says, come on, stand back, Sarada, although she's tired. So instead, as the Shins attack, Sarada rushes forward and proceeds to destroy stuff. And
activates her Sharingan.
Uses her Sharingan in combination with Sakura's super strength, basically. So that's kind of badass.
That is extremely awesome. It's a weird end to this in that it almost gave me the impression, like, well, we've wrapped things up pretty nicely now, haven't we? Like, what's left?
Yeah, I imagine it's really just at this point, you know, actually establishing exactly what's going on with their situation. But yeah, you know, Sarada has found her resolve, and she's just like, you know, I'm going to protect my mom this time. And she uses both of her parents' powers together and kicks ass.
Yeah. But I'm like, I guess this was essentially our climax finale of things.
Yeah. I mean, so I guess that this can't go on beyond, like, two more chapters, I would think.
Yeah, I was like, they just beat all the antagonists, so.
So I imagine that we'll be getting the wrap-up to this little post-series little story arc soon, but it's been a pretty good ride so far.
Yeah.
Nisekoi was stupid. One Piece!
Nisekoi had nudity in it, and I think it was supposed to be another Hot Springs episode. Which is so weird. I feel like you shouldn't be allowed to have, like, 20 of those, but they're finding a way. Also, I never realized that the cover of One Piece this week has Sanji specifically making Nami pastries, complete with little bun breasts, which is kind of disturbing when I stop to think about it.
Yeah, because there's one for Chopper, and it's like, oh, that's a cute little Chopper head, and then there's little mice, like, with mice croissants next to them. It's, oh, that's cute. And it's like, that Nami pastry has a...
very size-appropriate breasts, actually,
yeah.
Considering it's Nami. I'm more disturbed by the full-size Nami dough thing he's making.
What are you going to do with that, Sanji?
He's clearly put another piece of dough over her waist area, and I'm concerned. I'm like, is that...
That's her dress.
Oh, is that... Oh, okay, it's a dress. Okay. Yes. I thought it was him covering up the naughty bits he made into the dough.
Don't think you're too hard about it, Chopper. Don't worry. Anyway, chapter 791, Rubble. Last time, seemingly Luffy had struck the final blow. This chapter, yeah, he sure did. Luffy has punched Doflamingo out of the sky, through the earth, essentially. And the day is won. Luffy is completely drained at this point. He falls out of his Gear 4th almost immediately and collapses to the ground, steaming heap of tired, basically. And we cut to...
Steaming heap of tired is a really good, like, band song, I feel like.
We are steaming heap of tired!
Well, that's their song. We're like, we are all a steaming heap of tired.
Why do they have to be, like, Creed?
I'm still on that Nickelback train from earlier. Like, I'm a steaming pile crop of heat.
Anyway.
They forgot the words to their own song. It was really embarrassing.
We cut to underground. Doflamingo is dead? He doesn't look like he's getting up anytime soon.
And he's not dead, Nick. They don't die in One Piece. At least the major antagonists don't.
And his shattered sunglasses also fall to the ground. And so basically the entire rest of the chapter is just everyone reacting to the fact that Doflamingo's been defeated. They point up into the sky, and the birdcage is disappearing around Dressrosa, and Gyatz, who is still, you know, wounded from when Doflamingo attacked him, gets back on his microphone, and he's like, oh, it's the end of Doflamingo's rule! And all the people who are around the perimeter of Dressrosa trying to hold the birdcage back, they suddenly kind of all fall on their faces because they're not pushing against anything solid anymore. And, yeah, it was like, everyone's safe now. And Gyatz delivers a speech where he says, you know, the scene you're witnessing beyond the cage is not just a diced-up town, but a place devoid of manipulation, a land of freedom. The battle for Dressrosa, the Don Quixote family of pirates, the 2,000 strong, the warriors of fate drawn into an unlikely partnership, culminating in the final bout of Don Quixote, Doflamingo, Warlord of the Sea, versus Lucy the Gladiator. And he's just crying so hard that he can't even manage to get the words out, and it cuts to him, and his freaking... It's like he's crying from his mouth. It's so weird.
Oda does great crying faces, and what always makes me laugh is he says his inspiration for them is the faces he makes, like he tries to imagine himself that sad. So I like to think Oda says, like, oh, that's good. That's good.
Threw it in front of a mirror. So a whole bunch of people have flashbacks to, you know, all the hardships they had to endure. Riku remembers when Doflamingo first approached him. And Kairos remembers all the suffering that he endured when he was stuck as a toy. And Leo being there, you know, crying about how much the captain had done for them and stuff. And Rebecca is crying so much that, like, she kind of, like, cradles Luffy's head in her lap. And she's crying on top of him. And his face is getting fucking soaked.
I'd be like, you know what? I think it's really nice you used your lap as a pillow for him, you know, keep him from resting on the ground. I think it's really rude you're crying on him, though. That's very uncalled for. Not cool.
Yeah, a Kleenex.
Yeah, fucking put a blanket on him, something like that. His face is going to be sticky tomorrow now.
And so everyone is just like, oh, Lucy won! And Gyatz is crying, and the Marines are crying, and the citizens are crying, the Tuntutta are crying, and Usopp is crying, and Robin is smiling as Leo sobs into her tits, and Zoro is just kind of like, yeah, we won.
Yeah, Zoro's just smirking because that's what he does.
And Franky is like, oh, Tantana, we won. And Bartolomeo, while the Tantana are going, we did it, Bartolomeo goes, Habla Gabba Blue.
I can't wait till he joins Nick.
What the fuck was he even trying to say?
I like to think he didn't have a word to say, so he's just like, letters in my head, Habagabba Blue!
And this part actually really got me, because Kairos kind of looks back at the scene, and he just smiles to himself. It's this nice smile, and then in his flashback, he remembers being the toy soldier, and he's saying, you know, even a toy must protect that which is dear to it, even if these teen eyes can no longer shed tears of this own. We fight to take back our freedom, and then he kind of, it all sinks in, and he starts to cry after not being able to do so for, like, 10 years.
I love the final, like, little thing for this, too, where the narrator just says, it's not always a tragic event when a kingdom falls into ruin. Showing Dressrosa as it is now, with everything in absolute shambles. I mean, the only things you can actually see from here are Flower Hill, which has been devastated. You can see the half-left remainder of the statue of Pika and the Colosseum. Everything else is just...
It's not the horrible. Colosseum, it's the factory.
Is that the factory? I thought it was the Colosseum.
Maybe.
Because the factory got pushed over.
And the factory also kind of got wrecked despite everything, right?
I mean, it'll still be whole because it was supposedly made out of sea stone, but...
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
It's still going to be pretty well damaged, so... I just like that sentiment, though, like, it, you know, it's, you know, because you watch this, you're just like, oh, man, all that devastation, somebody got to tear them apart, but, like, it's not always a tragic event when it happens, because, you know, finally they can rejoice and weep among the rubble and go for a new day tomorrow. It's a very sweet chapter that ultimately acts as, I feel, the conclusion to this whole arc. I mean, there's going to be...
Oh, there's wrap-up.
Yeah, there's going to be wrap-up, there's going to be more to it, but...
It's one of those things where it's like, no one is going to say that the end of, you know, Crocodile's whole thing was when they were relaxing in the hot springs and Nami flashed all the guys, you know?
Yeah, there's going to be chapters of levity and all that, but this is essentially our payoff chapter of getting to see everything after Luffy's beaten them. I love the emotion to this chapter, seeing, you know, all the characters build up to it, all the characters crying because they just can't hold in how happy they are, particularly with Cryo's doing it. It was very sweet. But, Nick, what do you think about this arc as a whole now? Because I'm trying to think if I guess we covered all of Punk Hazard as well, but this one, I guess, would be the first major story arc of One Piece we've covered from beginning to end in One Piece.
Well, yeah, because we started off WMR around the time that Ace died, right?
It was after the time skip, because I knew I was doing weekly manga recap, like, in my room on camera. Right. I did that during the episode where they revealed the new designs. So I think we were probably a couple episodes into the Fishman Island, which was still, like, a smaller arc in and of itself. So we did all Punk Hazard.
And then we did Punk Hazard.
But that was almost like the, you know, the...
That was basically part of this arc.
It was part of, like, I guess the saga, you'd call it, or whatever. But... Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was like the first major arc we've covered from beginning to end on Weekly Manga Recap. What'd you think of it?
I thought it was quite good. I mean, there were a few times where I was like, I'm not sure if this is going to actually turn out too well. But seeing the whole thing, you know, they established all of the situation with Dressrosa and had, you know, all this build-up surrounding Doflamingo, which existed, of course, even before, you know, we were doing it, because he showed up years ago in One Piece as, you know, one of the emperors.
Mm-hmm.
And all that build-up, and showing how many people whose lives were fucked, and thus how many people were relying on Luffy to win, and then he did. And, yeah, so it's good.
I like it. I mean, I think there were down parts to it, but that was... I think most of those can be ignored as the fact of just, you know, reading it from week to week is different, since we were used to probably reading most of them relatively, you know, kind of like larger consumption kind of basis. And I think if I do reread this arc, or when I'd rather reread this arc as one lump sum, you know, in collected volumes, I might have even a different perception of it. But I really enjoyed this. I think that this did live up to a lot of my expectations. Maybe I think the only thing I would have wanted from it that we didn't get were more, like, individual fights for all the Straw Hats. But we still got that just from different characters, too. Plus, if Bartolomeo is a Straw Hat, then that also eventually retroactively counts, you know, so... I'm going to hold on to that. But I really liked it. I think this arc introduced a lot of really great characters. I'm astonished at how Oda at this point can just continue to create so many fun, dynamic kind of characters, you know, even at the point he is in the series over, like, what, 15 years into it?
Right.
And the guy's an absolute pro at that. And it had a tremendous amount of emotion. I think it actually, when you look at it, it's actually probably the most complicated arc he's done, too, because he tied a lot of stories together with this, between the Tatata, the toys, the, you know, the Bellamy, the actual royal family themselves. A lot of elements here were at play, so I have to give him props on that.
Hmm.
I wonder what the fuck Sanji's doing, though.
Yeah. I don't even remember if I read this. It was a coral golem?
Yeah, from last week.
It got cut up.
Do you want me to sum this one up for you, Nick?
Go ahead.
Okay, so they get to the city, Blue Grill. Yeah. Coral golem shows up, gets diced up into pieces, and a bunch of birds carried off.
And then there's a guy who looks all, like, interesting.
Yes. We see all the different chefs, and they're all kind of reacting to this town, and they react to all the different things of food. It's stuff that will only probably be used once in this series, so you can kind of take it in for the flavor, but it's not really going to matter all that much. Basically, though, the only thing worth really knowing is that Chiyo is like, oh, look at all the chefs getting fired up. I suppose it's time for me to give something in return. So we see far off, the pelicans have brought the chip pieces of the coral golem back. And they all repair themselves when suddenly another slash appears and dices it up again. And that dice is from Chiyo, who says, oh, ho, ho, now it won't be able to regenerate because I also knocked it out. So there's apparently some strong force here that looks like he has a monkey for a face, who's like, oh, most intriguing, gather the members. And that was it.
Okay.
That was it.
left very little impression.
Yeah.
Horn Trigger! Chapter 107, Osamu Mikumo, Part 12. Osamu is gonna go and try and become a better gunner. For first time in actually a while, we actually see Tamakoma 2 kind of splitting off to go and do their own stuff. Yuma says that he's going to go to their solo rank wars, and Chika's going to a sniper practice session, and Osamu, of course, is going to go and get special gunner training. So he goes to Arashiyama Squad's strategy room so that he can initially get coached by Arashiyama himself. Basically, he goes through the door. Apparently, Kitora's just, like, waiting there. Or maybe she heard him outside. I don't know. And she's just like, came in already. Jerk.
Oh, Nick.
Yeah, I know. I know you would have liked this. Yeah. So, yeah, anyway. So everyone is doing paperwork when Osamu heads in. And he's like, what were you guys working on? And they explain that, well, Kitora actually says, thanks to someone leaking information at the press conference, we are busy. So Tokyo says that basically because of the press conference, there are all these different applicants, and so they're trying to get through them all because they can't just have an enlistment ceremony once every 4 months. They have to do it once a month now. So, yeah. Made extra work for them because of the, you know, traveling into the neighborhood and all that stuff. So, Arashiyama then shows up, and basically they're like, okay, let's get into discussing shooting tactics and stuff. So, and, you know, Osamu says that he wants to be able to score points by himself. He explains the whole situation, and Arashiyama reestablishes, well, you know, but you've been doing all the tactics and stuff, and if you focus on that, aren't you gonna, you know, so on and so forth. And he says, yeah, I know, but I want us to have a way for me to score points myself, because I don't want us to just rely on Kuka. But Arashiyama says, well, to be blunt, I don't think that shooters and gunners need to score points by themselves, or rather, it's difficult for them to score points, because shooter and gunner triggers are weaker in power than attacker and sniper triggers. Basically, he breaks this down to the fact that Tryon has to be distributed differently between them. Essentially, with shooters, you get a combination of range and speed and power, whereas with, you know, attack triggers, you have to sacrifice the range, and that just gets put into power. With sniper triggers, you don't have the advantage of maneuverability and stuff. So both of them trade off those things for power, and gunners are more balanced, and thus they are less effective at getting points themselves. They work better when they cooperate with their teammates. And you've been good at that. So, yeah. So, Arashiyama says, okay, so what do you think are the strengths of a shooting trigger? And someone says, well, you can attack from afar, and you can also focus your attacks. And Arashiyama's like, yes, very good. And Ghidorah's just thinking to herself, I taught him that. And Osamu says, yeah, Ghidorah taught me that.
Oh, Nick! Plus 12 relationship points!
It's like, I just like that. You're putting all that aside, I like how Ghidorah is just kind of in her hole. Like, I taught him that.
She's a super twat in that moment. Like, and I taught him that. And he immediately gives her credit. And she's just like, oh.
Shut up.
Yeah, like, you know, if there was, like, another panel on her, she'd just be like, she'd just be like, if you took, like, a sock puppet and you just put your thumb up through the middle, like that frown Kermit makes, like, it'd just be like,
Kitora vastly underestimates Osamu's humility. So, Arashiyama says, well, okay, this is where shooting triggers are superior. Basically, you can participate from afar when your teammates are fighting, so you can support them. You can step away from the fight and see the overall picture and control the situation through shooting and tactics. That's how you make the best use of shooting triggers. For example, number one A rank Izumi is good at cornering enemies and letting his teammates snag points. So, that's very interesting, I think. We're just like, no, Osamu, you don't need to completely change the way that you are. So, presumably, this is going to continue the route of having Osamu be the tactician and stuff, but I guess have him be more effective at it? No.
Okay, techniques that'll make things work.
And, you know, Arashiyama says, you know, if you just try, you know, cramming these tricks, it's going to undermine your current mojo, but if you're willing to learn, it's a shame to miss out on the timing. So he says to their operator, Ayatsuji, to get the training stage set up, and he says, yeah, Mitsuru and I will give you the once-over, so try and keep up. But we're done with that for now, as we instead have to head to the joint sniper training session. Sorry. The cat's still on her head.
Doesn't go anywhere, Nick. It's following her. It needs to stay there so it can see the insides of Border and plot its destruction. That's why it switches to Toma, because he's taller and he can get a better vantage point.
Well, nobody cares about the cat just perching on their head. Oh, boy. Oh, and Kira is also there. She's like, oh, it's a cat! I love cats! Can I pet it? I can't tell because it's making a weird expression.
I feel for this poor girl, Nick. She's got this adorable expression on her face. She's just like, I want to pet a kitty, but I think it's angry. Or not. I don't... Why are cats just so fucking inconsiderate?
Yeah. So, yeah, we're introduced to a couple of other characters. Pompadour guy, who I think we've actually seen before.
Oh, yeah. He was part of, what was his name?
Fuyoshima Squad. Yeah.
Well, he was also part of the team that came to kidnap, or whatever, to get Yuma way back when.
Really?
Yeah, he was part of their team.
Oh, yeah, he was the guy that Kitora took out with her leg blade.
Yes.
Right. I don't know. And he was just like, I don't care.
He's like, you got me. Later.
Bye. So he sits next to a newer character, a kid with white or light-colored hair. So they have this standard sniping drill where basically they have to shoot this small target, which is 100 meters away, and it moves further away every 5 shots. So everyone is lining up and they're shooting stuff, and Chika does pretty well. She does 24th, and she's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I did pretty well, and Izuho got 47, so Chika says, oh, yeah, you're getting a lot better. And then they look over, and Narasaka has gotten first place. It's just, he's hit the bullseye every single time. So Narasaka greets Hira, who apparently is an apprentice, and Hira says, oh, you took first place again, that's amazing. He's like, well, not really. Go look at those two assholes. Because Toma and the light-haired kid, Yuzuru Ema, have drawn a smiley face and a star on their targets. Just because.
Just they're like, fuck you guys.
They're like, what the fuck were these guys doing? And so, you know, actually Narasaka says something kind of interesting, which is points don't tell the whole story. Which, I like that because it's kind of like there's a deeper meaning hidden in just beyond the test of, you know, you can't just judge everything based on our ranks, sort of thing.
And he's also like, yeah, I'm not actually as good as those guys, those fucks.
Not when we've got some talented free spirits hanging around. And very importantly, Yuzuru is B rank number 2 Kagura squad, so that means that he's going to be facing off with against Tamakoma in the next match.
And I imagine it might be setting up as some kind of antagonist for Chika to go up against.
Which is awesome. You know, I like more than just Yuma having a rival in these individual matches. This is the first time we're actually going to have, like, you know, build up for the sniper match. So yeah, good stuff.
Very good stuff. Good chapter.
Interesting way to introduce the, you know, the guy to, who's like, ah, just drew a smiley face. So yeah, that's it for the recap portion.
We're good.
All set. Managed to keep it under 2 hours this time, Chris.
I know. I was worried.
Okay. Well, thank you everyone for joining us here on twitch.tv/RoloT, where we normally do the show Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will be returning to that time next week, although for the rest of July, it looks like we're going to be sticking to Tuesdays because my schedule's all fucked up. Be sure to follow us on Twitter so you can stay updated on when exactly we're going to be doing the show. It'll probably be Tuesdays at 7 like we did tonight. He's at RoloT, I'm at YRuler of Time. We tweet out where and when we are live streaming the recording of the episode. Also, be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. You can check out all of our past stuff. and make sure to subscribe, leave criticism, questions, and suggestions, and all that stuff. And if you leave a rating and stuff on iTunes, we'd really appreciate that.
Yes.
Because, fuck woodworkers.
And we actually got several that I do need to give people credit for. Terrence Swift said, "This is a great listen every week, or a great listen for background sound. These two have an excellent funny report, and their ability to analyze is top-notch." We got one from Moss, who says, "I followed Roll of T and Wild Roll of Time a few years ago. It's actually thanks to the Weekly Manga Recap podcast that I not only was given a proper introduction to manga, but I've come to expand my abilities on how great stories are constructed." Aww. And finally, from 2-Bit Heroics, "This is one of my favorite podcasts of all time. Nick and Chris have wonderful chemistry with each other, and it's always fun to hear what they have to say about the new Shonen Jump manga each week." So thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. We appreciate every bit of feedback we can get. Also, remember, you can send in a suggestion for a future manga for us to read. Just email them to us. weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com is the address. And I'll be getting to the next series we'll be covering at the end of this whole shebang. Special thanks go out to Steve Mann, our tile artist. You can check out his work at neuroticfanboy.deviantart.com, idrawboobs.tumblr.com, and patreon.com/stevemann. Special thanks as well go out to The Infamous Planet and Felix Dark 2 for the visual editions of our podcast. Recently, Infamous Planet put out a classic Weekly Manga Recap visual edition, which was Usagi Drop. For some reason, all the ones where I rage heavily are very popular. Why don't you rage more, Chris?
I just don't think he wants to sit through all of fucking Frozen, or Freezing, whatever it was.
He's like, I'm not gonna read through this
shit. Yeah, he's like, hell, the fuck that, man.
I almost repeated myself. I'm sorry.
It's all good. So,
you can follow us on Twitter, isn't
it? Is that it, Nick? Do we have a recommendation?
Yeah, our suggestion for next time is a series that I mistakenly gave wrong information on a long time ago. Basically, I promised there would be a motorcycle riding bear in Biomeat. I was actually thinking of this series, which someone thought to remind me of in one of the suggestions, Biomega, which is a cyberpunk action story about a guy who rides around a motorcycle that has, like, an AI hologram program to do and stuff. Apparently, it's got some really weird moments and awesome action. Yeah.
I'm just going to read Biomeat again, like, come in next week and be like, didn't we do this one already?
Yes, we did, Chris.
This one was stupid again. Alright, well, ready to head off, Nick? I found something now. Normally, with Weekly Manga Recap, we don't like to get political, I imagine, Nick. Okay. But I found something that I'm amusing. It's a quiz. Are they defending the Redskins' name or the Confederate flag? It's a quiz.
Oh, no.
So I'm going to give you a quote. You have to tell me if it's defending the name of the Redskins or the Confederate flag.
Okay.
It is a symbol of everything we stand for. Strength, courage, pride, and respect.
Fuck. Confederate flag.
No, it was actually team owner Dan Snyder in a letter to fans written in 2013.
Respect. Is there anything else?
Quote, "It's just the selective outrage that I think is unfair."
Oh, that's hard. Confederate flag.
No, it was actually Lanny Davis, then a Redskins advisor during a 2013 radio interview. By the way, this is from Washington Post. Let me stop with this one. "We are not racist. We despise racism and bigotry. And we think the people who are creating this cultural cleansing are the real bigots in this story."
That could be either one. I'm not going to bother guessing either one.
It was the Confederate flag by Ben Scooter Jones, the actor and former U.S. congressman, on his Facebook page.
God.
Oh.
That's bad, man. Also, congrats to gay marriage and stuff, by the way.
Yes. Oh, also on the topic of marriage, and I feel bad this is kind of at the end, but congrats to Annalise, who just got married herself.
Yeah,
so,
wonderful news. Congratulations.
Very awesome. And I guess if you're listening right now, we haven't actually stopped the recording yet, but those who are listening afterwards probably won't matter. Just as a reminder, this is the last day to message Annalise to get into the Osamu Makomu fan club and have a chance to win copies of Rush. I actually have the copies right here. So you can hear them. They are real. They're right here. They're waiting to be won. And all you have to do is join the fan club. But if you're listening to this now, I'm like, fuck, you had like fucking weeks to do this, so you can't blame me for just hearing it now. Anyway, that's it. Bye.
Bye.